You're listening to Big Ideas, the only regularly scheduled television program in North America devoted to the art of the lecture and the importance of ideas in public life. It is broadcast on TVO every Saturday and Sunday at 4 p.m. For more information on our program, go to our website at tvo.org/bigideas.
Ladies and gentlemen, much has been written on the relationship of trials and theater, and how trials are, or should be, or in some cases, in the view of some, shouldn't be, a form of theater. My contention in these lectures flows from these discussions, and it is that great moments in great trials have a particular affinity with literature and with dramatic oratory, and they can be studied and they can be appreciated as such. Most simply, this is evident in what I call great trials, by which I mean trials about issues of importance to society, and in which there is an understood reference to an audience outside the courtroom, which is to say the wider public, but perhaps even more important than this, an audience that to some extent includes us. And so I invite you to join with me as members of the audience of the three great trials that I'm going to speak about this evening. To me, at least, these great moments occur when the participants realize that they are in such a moment and they elevate their rhetoric beyond the immediate issues at stake in the trial and speak in a voice that transcends the language of the law. The distinguished American constitutional scholar Milner Ball of the University of Georgia makes the point that a trial is not a scientific laboratory or a research library. Rather, it's a form of dramaturgy. And the task of the advocate in a trial, he says, is the persuading of the decision makers. And this involves a highly literary device, he says, and he calls it the passage from fact to metaphor, and I quote him, "The passage from fact to metaphor is what the advocate seeks. It is the passage from the materials of fact and law, the text of the drama, by means of the courtroom presentation, which is the performance, to a persuasive statement of what ought to be done in a given situation." And that's the metaphor. Now, I want to illustrate this over the course of these two lectures. I want to illustrate this in action through a focus on three utterly different cases. The first, the one I'm going to talk about this evening, the case of Oscar Wilde in the Old Bailey in London in 1895, the second, the trial of Nikolai Bukharin and others in Moscow in 1938. And lastly, the opening moments of the trial of the major German war criminals at Nuremberg, beginning November 1945. So let me begin with Oscar Wilde this evening. Background. I'm really talking about three trials which occurred in the Old Bailey in 1895. The first of these, as many of you know, was a libel trial. And then there followed two criminal trials in which Oscar Wilde was charged with gross indecency with another male person, to use language from the charge. At the center of this drama is the great novelist and playwright Oscar Wilde, at the very height of his career, when these events began, but indeed he had only 5 years to live. Wilde has been described as the first modern celebrity. He was certainly the most famous playwright of his day, and his importance of being earnest was playing to sellout crowds and has been called the most popular English play of all times. And his novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, was an unprecedented succès scandale that preceded these three trials. Wilde was a brilliant man about town, a spectacular socialite, particularly in what we would probably call the homosexual scene of the London underworld. He was an Anglo-Irish writer of great brilliance and distinction, and he was known, in addition to his writing, for his charm, his wit, his generosity, his lavish spending, and his dazzling conversation and bon mot. The best of these bon mots, at least the one which I love, comes from the very end of his life, when he was in fact very, very ill and on his deathbed in Paris, living on the Rue des Beaux-Arts in a hotel room, and he is supposed to have looked up from his bed and said, "Either that wallpaper goes or I do." And in the end, he died. This is an illustration of Wilde's legendary wit. Heedless of the circumstance, he couldn't resist getting off the great line. And that's one of the things that did him in his trial. I'll come to that in a moment. Now the story. His great misfortune, Wilde's great misfortune, was the father of his then partner, another man about town, Lord Alfred Douglas, known as Bosie. Bosie's father was John Sholto Douglas, the 9th Marquess of Queensbury, a divorced and crotchety Scottish nobleman and famous atheist, best known for having invented the Marquess of Queensbury rules for boxing, an achievement that, it has been said, brought together his tastes for belligerent and litigiousness. The story begins in 1894, when the flamboyant, then 40-year-old Wilde, married and with two children, was having an affair with Bosie, then 24. That spring, as Wilde's fame reached dazzling heights, Queensbury set out to break up the relationship between his son and the notorious Wilde. Now, some sense of what Wilde was up against comes from three of the Marquess's letters that actually ended up in court, and what must surely rank as among the nastiest exchanges a father ever had with his son. I'm going to cite passages from these letters and note how they get increasingly nasty. The first, October 1st, 1894. After chewing out his son, this is the Marquess of Queensbury's letter to Bosie, after chewing out Bosie for having done nothing after he left Oxford, quote, "with discredit to yourself," he then swings into his real concern, quote, "your intimacy with this man Wilde. It must either cease or I will disown you and stop all money supplies. I am not going to try to analyze this intimacy, and I make no charge, but to my mind, to pose as a thing is as bad as to be it. With my own eyes, I saw you both in the most loathsome and disgusting relationship, as expressed by your manner and expression. Never in my experience have I ever seen such a sight as that in your horrible features. No wonder people are talking as they are. I now hear on good authority, but this may be false, that his wife is petitioning to divorce him for sodomy and other crimes. Is this true, or do you know of it? If I thought the actual thing was true and it became public property, I should be quite justified in shooting him on sight. These Christian English cowards and men, as they call themselves, want waking up." And he signed, "your disgusted so-called father, Queensbury." To which Bosie responded in a telegram the next day, April 2nd. Only a few words, "what a funny little man you are." To which the Marquess replied the following day, You impertinent young jackanape. I request that you will not send any such messages to me by telegraph. If you send me any more or come with any impertinence, I will give you the thrashing you deserve. Your only excuse is that you must be crazy. I hear from a man at Oxford that you were thought to be crazy there, and that accounts for a good deal that has happened. If I catch you again with that man, I will make a public scandal in a way you little dream of. It is also a suppressed one. I prefer an open one, and at any rate, I shall not be blamed for allowing such a state of things to go on. Unless this acquaintance ceases, I shall carry out my threat and stop all supplies. And if you are not going to make any attempt to do something, I shall certainly cut you down to a mere pittance so you know what to expect. Time passes, and towards the end of the summer, Queensberry writes again to his son, Bosey. You miserable creature. How right I was to face every horror and misery I have done rather than run the risk of bringing more creatures into the world like yourself. And that was the entire and only reason of my breaking off with your mother as a wife. So intensely was I dissatisfied with her as the mother of you children. You must be demented. There is madness on your mother's side, and indeed, few families in this Christian country are without it if you look into them. So this is a formidable enemy, and Wilde felt he had to do something about it. About half a year later, in February 1895, with Wilde's fame being, if anything, greater than at the beginning of this quarrel, the appearance of The Importance of Being Earnest, it was playing in the West End, Queensberry went to Wilde's club, the Albemarle, and handed the hall porter an envelope with a card on which the scrawl was eventually made out to read what Wilde called those hideous words. And those hideous words were, "For Oscar Wilde, posing as a sodomite," unquote. He meant sodomite. Whereupon, in an effort to put a stop to the harassment, Wilde made a disastrous decision, which I might say could be a continuing lesson to other people who want to go to court for various unnecessary reasons. Wilde decided to see his solicitor, Charles Humphreys, and to sue Queensberry for libel. The libel trial. The trial opened on April 3rd, 1895, at the Old Bailey, before Mr. Justice R. Hen Collins. Queensberry was charged with what was called defamatory libel. Queensberry, in response, filed a plea of justification, taking on the challenge of having to prove that what he had written was true and that it had been published through the putting of the card on the tray for the public good. Wilde entered this process supremely confident. He was utterly certain that the eccentric Scot could not prove justification. And indeed, he assured his lawyers that there was no truth whatever in what Queensberry had alleged. One of the reasons Wilde was so confident was that he had secured the services of one of the great barristers of the day, Sir Edward Clarke, QC, MP, a former Solicitor General, who, it is said, gave the appearance of a nonconformist parson and who was a pillar of the legal establishment. What Wilde did not count on was the gentleman that Provost Orchard mentioned. The brilliant defense lawyer, another Irishman, Edward Carson, MP, who was actually a classmate of Wilde's at Trinity College Dublin in the early 1870s. Wilde also did not count on Queensberry's dogged determination to go to any lengths to expose Wilde's sordid society, which relates to a subtext about which some uncertainties remain. And this is interesting. This subtext, and you have to keep this in mind as this story rolls along, concerns Queensberry's other son, his eldest son, Viscount Drumlanrig, who apparently had an affair with none other than the Liberal Prime Minister of England, Lord Rosebery, and who was supposedly killed in a shooting accident the previous October, but who seems in reality to have committed suicide. Queensberry had made lavish use of private detectives to get to the bottom of the Rosebery connection. Unbeknownst to Wilde, Queensberry lined up close to a dozen male prostitutes and shady characters ready to testify to Wilde's sexual transgressions. Carson also had some incriminating correspondence from Wilde's own pen, and to preempt this, Sir Edward Clark, Wilde's lawyer, actually introduced some of this correspondence himself. And among the most spectacular of these was Wilde's letter to Bosie. Famous letter, I quote it, "My own boy, your sonnet is quite lovely. It is a marvel that those red rose leaf lips of yours should have been made no less than for the music of song than for the madness of kisses. Your slim gilt soul walks between passion and poetry. Why are you alone in London, and when do you go to Salisbury? Do you go there to cool your hands in the gray twilight of Gothic things and come here whenever you like? It is a lovely place. It only lacks you, but go to Salisbury first. Always with undying love, yours, Oscar." So suddenly, Wilde faced all kinds of evidence he did not expect to see in court. In defense of Wilde, Clark's contention, which seems to have actually backfired, was that Wilde, what do you want? Wilde was a literary celebrity whose prose was to be understood as a sign of refined sensibility rather than what was for the Victorians a gross perversion. As he said, this is Clark, "The words of that letter, gentlemen, may appear extravagant to those in the habit of writing commercial correspondence." Laughter in the court. "Or those ordinary letters which the necessities of life force upon one every day. But Mr. Wilde is a poet, and the letter is considered by him as a prose sonnet, and one of which he is in no way ashamed and is prepared to produce anywhere as the expression of true poetic feeling and with no relation whatever to the hateful and repulsive suggestions put to it in the plea in this case." The most famous part of the trial, studied, I am told, by law students to this day, is Edward Carson's devastating cross-examination of Wilde, which lasted a day and a half and has been called one of the most bruising encounters in English legal history. All the more remarkable because Carson was suffering from a bad cold at the time. It began very badly. Wilde was called to the stand and claimed that he was 39 years old. "Carson, I think you're over 40. The 41-year-old Carson claimed, and of course, as a former schoolmate, he knew exactly how old Wilde was. Carson's purpose here was to show the disparity in age between that 24-year-old Bosie and the 40-year-old Wilde. It's only 1 year, but it immediately, it began with the cross-examination immediately pointing up Wilde to be, shall we say, flexible with the truth. Still, in all, Wilde was in high spirits, and he presented himself as an aesthete of refined sensibility. This is the beginning of the exchange. Carson, you are of the opinion, I believe, that there is no such thing as an immoral book. Wilde, yes. Carson, may I take it that you think, and now Carson is referring to a poem not written by Wilde in a periodical with which Wilde was associated. May I take it that you think the priest and the acolyte, that's the story, you can imagine, was not immoral? Wilde, it was worse. It was badly written. And later, Carson asked, are you saying that pleasure is the only thing one should live for? Wilde, I think that the realization of oneself is the prime aim of life, and to realize oneself through pleasure is finer than to do so through pain. I am on that point entirely on the side of the ancients, the Greeks. It is a pagan idea. Things began to turn sour for Wilde when Carson quoted long passages from Wilde's novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, including a leading character's confession to Dorian Gray, quote, from the moment I met you, your personality had the most extraordinary influence over me. I quite admit that I adored you madly, extravagantly, absurdly. Now, Carson, now I ask you, Mr. Wilde, do you consider that description of the feeling of one man toward a youth grown up, just grown up, was a proper or improper feeling? Wilde, I think it was the most perfect description of what an artist would feel on meeting a beautiful personality that was in some way necessary to his art and life. Carson, the affection and love of the artist of Dorian Gray might lead an ordinary individual to believe that it might have a certain tendency. Wilde, I have no knowledge of the views of ordinary individuals. It goes on. I can't give you more than just the flavor of it, but let me cite one academic, Neil McKenna, who describes Carson's technique, quote, fast on his feet, moving with lightning speed from one topic to another and back again, ambushing Oscar, who found himself ill-prepared for such an encounter. Carson began with the literary part of the case. His technique of cross-examination was simple but devastating. He would take a damning position about the work in question and invite Oscar to agree with him. Carson's questions came in short and fast and repetitive, like the staccato fire of a machine gun. Had he read Bosie's poems? Did he approve of them? Were they improper? Was the priest and the acolyte improper? Was it wrong? Was it immoral? Was it blasphemous? Was it scandalous? Was it sodomitical? Had Oscar publicly devoured it? If not, why not? And so on and so on. Stronger on literature than on the rest of the evidence, Wilde began to wilt as the cross-examination went on and as the details poured out. At one point, as the evidence was building up that Wilde had consorted with male prostitutes and other shiftless boys, Wilde was asked about Walter Granger, who was 16 years old and a waiter in Lord Douglas's rooms. Did you ever kiss him? Carson asked. Oh dear no, said Wilde. He was a particularly plain boy. He was, unfortunately, extremely ugly. I pitied him for it. Carson, was that the reason you did not kiss him? Carson pressed. And Wilde replied, oh, Mr. Carson, you are pertinently insolent. Thereafter, Wilde seemed to crumble. My transcript of the proceedings says that the witness began several answers almost inarticulately, and none of them he finished. his efforts to collect his ideas were not aided by Mr. Carson's sharp, staccato repetition. Why did you add that? At last the witness answered, "You sting me and insult me and try to unnerve me. And at times one says things flippantly when one ought to speak more seriously. I admit it." By the third day, Sir Edward Clark had had enough. After he had a chat with Carson, Wilde's side capitulated. Clark agreed to the plea of justification being allowed, accepting not only that Queensberry had been justified in what he had said, the horrible words on the card, but that it had been done in the public interest. The jury agreed, and Mr. Justice Collins wrote a nice little note to Carson congratulating him on his victory and on his cross-examination. End of trial one. The next chapter, and it picks up steam from here, the next chapter began with Wilde's arrest on charges of committing indecent acts, charges made virtually inevitable after the court's ruling that Queensberry had acted in the public interest. And so Wilde spent about a month in prison waiting for the next trial. This trial, before the Honorable Mr. Justice Charles, with the lead prosecutor being Mr. Charles Frederick Gill, and with Wilde represented again by Sir Edward Clark, in this trial, Oscar faced 25 counts of gross indecency and related crimes, and with a series of blackmailers and male prostitutes and others with lurid stories to tell. Now, I finally got to the famous moment in A Great Trial, and I think this is on both scores, this is the famous moment. The famous moment is the moment at which the embattled Wilde made his memorable appeal to the audience in the courtroom, but also outside the courtroom, and it came in Gill's cross-examination of Wilde, focusing on a line in one of Bosie's poems. And the famous line is, "I am the love that dare not speak its name." Gill wanted to know if this alluded to what Gill called unnatural love. "No," said Wilde. And then Gill asked, "Well, what is the love that dare not speak its name?" At which point, Wilde made his remarkable reply. And I want to quote it to you here. "The love that dare not speak its name in this century is such a great affection of an elder for a younger man as there was between David and Jonathan, such as Plato made the very basis of his philosophy, and such as you find in the sonnets of Michelangelo and Shakespeare. It is that deep spiritual affection that is as pure as it is perfect. It dictates and pervades great works of art like those of Shakespeare and Michelangelo, and those two letters of mine, the letters I have referred to, such as they are. It is in this century misunderstood, so much misunderstood that it may be described as the love that dare not speak its name. And on account of it, I am placed where I am now. It is beautiful. It is fine. It is the noblest form of affection. There is nothing unnatural about it. It is intellectual, and it repeatedly exists between an elder and a younger man when the elder man has intellect and the younger man has all the joy, hope, and glamour of life before him. That it should be so, the world does not understand. The world mocks at it and sometimes puts one in the pillory for it." And then he stopped, and then there was loud applause in the courtroom, mingled with some hisses. On the fifth day of the trial, the jury retired and could not reach a verdict. And so the third trial opened on May 20th before Mr. Justice Sir Alfred Wills. This was a very different atmosphere. It must have felt dark and sinister for Wilde. including intensified public interest. Mr. Justice Wills' charge to the jury was very harsh. I quote him, "I would rather try the most shocking murder case that has ever been my lot to try than to be engaged in a case of this description." Much of the case turned on Wilde's claim to be an artist, someone whose correspondence should not be understood in an everyday sense. But this is how Wills addressed the jury about that correspondence. "Mr. Wilde claims to be an exceptional person, and it is therefore becomes a question of how much allowance may be made for this fact. I may be dull myself, but speaking personally, I cannot see the extreme beauty of the language said to be used." On May 25th, after a couple of hours, the jury returned with a verdict, guilty on all counts but one. Mr. Justice Wills pronounced this, I quote, "the worst case I have ever tried involving a center of a circle of extensive corruption of the most hideous kind among young men." He then sentenced Wilde to 2 years at hard labor, adding that, I quote, "in my judgment, this is totally inadequate for a case such as this." Oscar Wilde seemed stunned. "And I," he asked, "may I say nothing, my lord?" Wills merely waved his hand dismissedly. Wilde then went to prison for 2 years, and it virtually killed him. When he emerged from prison, he was ill. He traveled a bit. He went to Paris, and that was when he died. Three conclusions. The first, I think one that will surprise no one, is that public opinion was severely hostile to Wilde. Note that even in his stirring defense of the love that dare not speak its name, Wilde is evasive or in denial, and understandably so, on the subject of homosexuality. The scholar Michael Foldy, quote, Wilde was the victim of a kind of homophobic moral panic of a feared and threatened society. But there was not only homophobia at work here, but also clashes of class and culture. Again, Foldy. Wilde's inappropriate whimsicality was as intellectually amusing to the solidly middle-class courtroom audience as his flippant tone and casual disdain for the proceedings were socially and culturally alienating. Again, the man who couldn't resist the bon mot, the clever line, the witty response. In other words, Wilde's aestheticism put him on an alien wavelength, not only for the jurors, but for the public at large. Just one example. Carson asked him about the My Own Boy letter. "Was this an ordinary letter?" Wilde said, "No, it was a beautiful letter." "Apart from art?" said Carson. Wilde's reply, "I cannot answer apart from art." Second, the age of the blackmailer. Wilde's biographer, Richard Ellman, notes that the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1885, the statute on which, for the violation of which Wilde was convicted, for the first time prohibited indecent relations between consenting male adults. This ushered in the age of the blackmailer. There is a strong suggestion from the evidence that Queensberry, fed by his suspicions over his dead son Drumlanrig, was engaged in some blackmail of his own, pressuring Lord Rosebery, threatening disclosure of the Prime Minister's and perhaps other Liberal politicians' homosexual relations. And this pressure actually seems to have worked. That's probably why Wilde was recharged after the failure of the jury to convict him in the first criminal case. And secondly, another of Queensberry's objectives seems to have been achieved to keep Bosie's name out of it. The evidence for this is inconclusive, but what we do know is that Rosebery seems to have had a nervous collapse that largely incapacitated him precisely over the period of these trials, from late February to the end of May. The evidence is hardly overwhelming, but it's plausible enough to warrant serious consideration. In other words, the suggestion is that Queensberry was so angry at Rosebery that he displaced this anger onto Wilde. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, a point to which I've alluded on several occasions, Wilde was, in part, the author of his own undoing. Wilde's brilliant insight, and it certainly was brilliant, was clouded in his own case by his even more powerful narcissism. And that, I think, is evident on almost every page of his cross-examination. Wilde erred not only in bringing the libel trial in the first place, but also in the way that he presented himself as a misunderstood genius who didn't have to play by the rules. Wilde was not only defending himself for posing as a sodomite, but as an elite artist who is above the standards of mere ordinary people, something which could hardly be lost on the jury, and indeed the two judges in the criminal trials. Why didn't he flee abroad? This is what all of his friends urged him to do. Go to France, stay there for a few years, and then come back. Forget about it. Wilde would not hear of it. And he wouldn't hear of it even after the first case, the libel trial, failed so badly. Again, his friends pleaded with him not to do this. Now, the easiest answer, and with this I'll close, the easiest answer is the narcissism, is the fact that he couldn't resist the lines that he was going to toss off, that as London's most brilliant conversationalist, he would best the opposing lawyers in cross-examination. And there's a lot of truth in that. But Neil McKenna suggests another reason, and I don't know how you will feel about it. I think it is a noble reason. But that is, quite simply, his love for Bosie. His love for Bosie stood in the way. As Neil McKenna says, a dishonored name, a hunted life, are not for me, to whom you have been revealed on that high hill where beautiful things are transfigured. Sorry, those are Wilde's own words, which he expressed to Bosie, and I think they explain a good deal of what happened. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attention.